Rosh Hashanah, Perek Beis, Mishnah Aleph 2:1, and one more Mishnah on the topic of Eidus, testimony regarding seeing the new moon. The rule is in general that Midda'oraisa, any Jew is assumed to be kosher, has a Chezkas Kashrus, and would be acceptable as a witness. However, as the Mishnah will go on to say, there were malicious heretical Jews by Susim and Kusim, etc., who had an agenda to undermine the process, and therefore at some point, as the Mishnah will set forth, they changed it so that it wouldn't accept any old person who shows up with testimony unless we recognize him, we know who he is, or we have other people who we do know and trust acting as witnesses, a pair, to confirm that this witness who saw the moon is someone on whom we can rely. And therefore the Mishnah says, Im einan makirin oso, if they, the Sanhedrin, don't know him, the person who saw the new moon, Mishalchen acher imo lahaido. So we send another with him to testify and confirm that he, the witness who saw the moon, is reliable. Now the word acher is singular as opposed to acherim, but it can't be the pshat here that we send one other person because that's not sufficient for testimony. So acher here means another pair of two witnesses will go to accompany this one person to confirm that he is a kosher Jew whose testimony is acceptable in the Sanhedrin. Barishono hayu makavun elus chodesh mikol adam. Originally, they would accept the testimony regarding seeing the new moon from anybody, any Jew. Mishikilkulu haminim. However, once the heretical sects, a min is any heretical sect, they deny the existence of God or his unity or the veracity of the Torah, whether Shebaal Peh or Bechsav, they're called the min. These particular minim are the Baisusim. The Baisusim were a group very much like the Sadukim, the Sadducees, who accept the Torah Shebechsav, the written Torah, as legitimate, but rejected the Torah Shebaal Peh, the tradition, the oral tradition, regarding how to understand the Torah. And in fact, in the Gemara, Dav Chav Beis Amud Aleph, the Mishnah's Girsa in the Bavli is actually Baisusim, although that is actually probably incorrect. The older versions in the Mishnah, as we have them in front of us today, say min, probably just changed for the Christian censors, because Christians, early Christians, were also minim. They're also a heretical sect of Jews. In any case, these Baisusim were malicious, and they tried to cause mischief, as I'll explain in a minute. And once the Sanhedrin realized that was going on, hiskinu, they made a takana, they made an enactment. Shelo hayu makalden ele min hamakirim. They didn't accept testimony from anybody other than those people who they recognize and knew, and that they knew could be trusted to give legitimate testimony. Now, 2 points. The lesser point is on the word hiskinu, a takana. So rabbinic enactments basically come in two flavors, gezeros and takanos. A gezera is a protective fence to ensure that a doraisa is not trampled, extending the bounds of the what's restricted in the law. A takana is like a social enactment that recognizes that society isn't living up to its what the Torah expected of it, and therefore have to change the rules because society isn't playing by the rules which the Torah was assuming. So a takana is essentially, since people have changed, the rules have to change. Now obviously if the Torah is perfect, the system is going to be, there'll be unintended consequences every time you make a takana, and that's an important rule to keep in mind. Every tikkun, every takana, every adjustment to the rules has with it consequences which are perhaps negative, but the rabbis decided that the good outweighs the bad. So that's always the case in every takana, necessarily so since the Torah is perfect. If you fiddle with perfect, obviously you're going to get something that's imperfect. And that's the case here as well, of course. Now, it's very sad that we'll reject a legitimate kosher Jew who shows up trying to give testimony and meaning well, but the Chazal understood the alternative was worse. Now, what in the world were these Baisusim trying to do? What was in it for them to undermine the process? So, it seems that the Baisusim understood that when it comes to the Korban Omer, the bringing of the Korban Omer, it's to be brought, as the Pasuk says, Mimacharas HaShabbos, the day after the Shabbos, and the Torah Shebaal Peh, the tradition is that the Shabbos we're referring to in that Pasuk is the first day of Pesach, the 15th of Nisan, and therefore the time to bring the Korban Omer is the 16th of Nisan. And that's our tradition, that's what we do. However, the Baisusim understood that the Shabbos of the Pasuk refers to specifically a Saturday, a Shabbos. And therefore, when it says it has to be brought Mimacharas HaShabbos, the day after the Saturday, it means to be brought on a Sunday, Yom Rishon, the first day of the week. even if that's not the day immediately after Pesach. It could be during Chol HaMoed Pesach. And therefore, it seems once it happened that the 30th day of the month of Adar came out on a Shabbos. And the Bais Susim wanted that day to be decreed as Rosh Chodesh, because that would make the 1st of Nisan be Shabbos, which would mean that the 8th and the 15th of Nisan would also be a Shabbos, which would mean that the 15th of Nisan, the first day of Pesach, would be a Shabbos. So that means the next day, the 16th of Nisan, when the Sanhedrin would arrange, when the Beis HaMikdash would bring the Korban Omer, it would be on the 16th of Nisan, which would come out on a Sunday, Yom Rishon, the day after Shabbos. And they wanted that to happen. So even though the moon wasn't visible, or there weren't witnesses necessarily who saw the new moon, the Bais Susim went to lie to try to arrange that to happen. The Sanhedrin figured out what was going on, and therefore things didn't go bad. But nevertheless, once they realized this was happening, they decreed that we're not accepting witnesses without us knowing who they are, so we know we can trust them. Rosh Hashanah Perek Beis, Mishnah Beis, 2-2. If you recall in the previous Perek, the third Mishnah, we talked about the shluchim, the emissaries who would go from the Sanhedrin to notify the Jewish communities beyond Jerusalem that the new moon had been seen and the new month had been declared. The Mishnah picks up at that topic, going back to the topic, and says, Barishona, originally, they didn't use shluchim, emissaries at all. Hayu Masin Masos. Instead, they used fire signals. They had hills, as we'll see in the Mishnah in a moment, that they had beacons. They waved torches, lit torches, and used a system of signaling to notify the larger Jewish community outside Jerusalem and on that the new moon had been decreed. See, the new month had been declared, I should say. So, Brishon Hayu Masin Masos, they originally did that. However, Mishakilklu Has Kusim, once the Kusim, a different heretical sect, you remember the Kusim are a little more complicated. They're the ones who were imported from the place called Kusa in the First Temple period after Sennacherib had exiled the Ten Lost Tribes. They were imported, and the local lions were attacking these Kusim. They reasoned that the local god disapproved their behavior, so they converted to the local religion of Judaism. The rabbis are looking very askance at this conversion, not knowing whether or not to trust it. Later on, in the time of the Gemara, we already confirmed that they still had an idol in Har Gerizim in the shape of a dove, which they worshipped. Therefore, they were for sure idolatrous in nature and not considered to be Jews. But in the time of the Mishnah, there was sort of a split opinion if they should be considered Jews or otherwise. At all events, in our Mishnah, we see the Kusim are malicious, as they're called Samaritans in English. I know the expression, the good Samaritan from the New Testament, but in our tradition, that they weren't good Samaritans. I think New Testament is an unacceptable expression. So if it is, forgive me. I just meant what the Christians have as their Bible. Eventually the Kusim caused mischief. They were malicious and also undermined the process. And therefore, Hiskinu, they made another takana, Shiyu Shluchin Yotzin, that instead of using fire signals and torches to wave, as we'll explain in the next Mishnah, they sent Shluchim, emissaries from the Sanhedrin, instead. Now, just to make sure we're on the same page, just what's going on over here before I move on to the next Mishnah, what's happening is we're saying that on the let's say from the previous Mishnah, there's our picture. On the Friday night, the witness sees the new moon. So on Shabbos day, on Saturday morning, he'll show up in the Sanhedrin, he'll give his testimony, they'll declare that the new moon. So then that night, Saturday night, Motzi Shabbos, they would then have these fire signals to notify everyone that this morning was Rosh Chodesh, and therefore, when they're actually waving the fires, it's already the second day, the beginning of the second day of the new month. Okay? In the event that they didn't declare the new month after 30 days from the last one, meaning if it wasn't a chaser, a 29-day month, but instead it was a 30-day month, so then they would not bother to do this signaling system on the 31st day from the previous Rosh Chodesh, meaning if the previous month was 30 days, they wouldn't say, this morning we declared the new moon, new month, and today is now this morning was now the Rosh Chodesh after a 30-day month previously. They wouldn't bother because, as I explained before, every Jewish month either is 29 or 30 days. You can't have a 31-day month. So it's automatic that in the event that they don't do Kiddush HaChodesh on day 30, then they'll do it on day 31. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Beis, Mishnah Gimel, 2-3. Now the Mishnah describes how they went about using these fire signals. Ketzed hayu masiyin masos. How did they go about waving these torches as fire signals? Mevien klunsaos shel erez. They brought long poles made of cedar wood. Cedar is a hard wood, doesn't burn very quickly, so you can get a long burn out of these things without them burning down. Arukin, they were long. V'kan v'atze shemen v'ne'or shel pishtan. They also brought kanim, are like reeds. Atze shemen is literally means like oily wood. It's referring to shemen afar simon. This is like the wood from which they made balsam oil. It took balsam oil. U'ne'or shel pishtan. And the debris from the manufacture of flax towards linen, so that also those three things burn brightly to cause a big fire. The chorech b'meshicha. Those three things, the kanim, the atzei shemen, and the orosh al pishtan, were tied to the top of the cedar pole. I think it was like an overgrown matchstick to make a very big fire. V'ol l'rosh ahar, they went up to the top of a mountain that they'd use for signaling. U'matzis behen, esa'ur, they would light the fire then so that they have as large a fire as possible on the end of this pole. Umolich, umevi, umalo morid, they would wave these burning poles. Molech umevi means like to and fro, malo morid, up and down. The point is they move them in different directions so that people at a great distance away wouldn't think they're like shooting stars or something. They realize they're the poles themselves in distance because they're, of course, at a great distance. They're just tiny flecks of light. Achihu roa, the person doing the waving of the torch will keep on doing so until he sees the next signal hill over, also with a similar light waving to and fro. And the same goes for the third as they move the signal across Eretz Yisrael and beyond towards Babel. Each step along the way until the signal went all the way from Jerusalem until the Babylonian community. Rosh Hashanah Perek Beis, Mishnah Dalet, 2-4. The Mishnah describes the path of the signaling from Jerusalem to the community in Babylonia. Ume'ayin hayu masiyin masos. And where was it that they did these fire signaling from? Mehar ha-mishcha l'sartava. They started in Har HaMishcha, that is the Mount of Olives, right across to the east of the Har HaBayis in Jerusalem. So that was the first hilltop. Then it would move northwards. The exact identification of these different mountains as we go is not clear, but the general idea is presumed to be moving up the country of Israel from Jerusalem to the Galil, ending up presumably in the mountains near Hermon, on the what's today the Lebanese-Syrian border. And then somehow across the east towards Buffalo. So, l'Sartava, u'misartava l'Grofina, from the Sartava mountain to Grofina hill, u'migrofina l'Chavran, u'michavran l'Beis Biltin. From Chavran to Beis Biltin, Beis Biltin is said to be the signaling area that's closest to Babel, modern-day Iraq. From Beis Biltin, they didn't move from there. They waved their fire signal. They would just wave it back and forth. Those people wouldn't leave that spot until they saw the whole area before them, referred to as Kol HaGola, or the exile literally, lit up like a bonfire. Now the Gemara says that the Gola is referring to the city of Pumbedisa, which Rush explains in Sanhedrin is considered to be the name for the Gola because it was the first and primary establishment of the Jewish community in Babylonia. Rosh Hashanah Perek Beis, Mishnah Hei, 2-5. The Mishnah returns the topic of the receiving of the witnesses after a two Mishnah digression regarding the signaling system with the fires. The Mishnah says, Chatzer gadola haisa v'Yerushalayim. There was a large courtyard in Jerusalem. Uveis Ya'azek haisa nikres. It was called Beis Ya'azek. Ya'azek means like walled in by a by a wall. So Beis Hazek means like the area that's walled in. Ulisham kol ha'edim miskansim. And into there, all of the witnesses who arrived to testify, they would gather. According to most Mefarshim, we're talking specifically about Shabbos, although the Rambam seems to understand, as we'll see why in the Mishnah shortly, that that was the place that they gathered every day of the week, whenever they arrived to give their testimony. Uvezdin bodkin osam sham, and the Beis Din would examine the witnesses there. So according to most, on Shabbos, according to the Rambam, every day of the week. Usudos gadolos osan lehem, they would prepare large meals, like a big buffet over there for the witnesses who arrived. Bishvil shayu ragilin lavo, so that they would be accustomed to come, meaning they are encouraged to come because by showing up they get a delicious large breakfast. And for the brunch, that'll encourage them to come for their troubles. Barishonu lohayu zazim misham kol hayom. Originally, if they arrived on Shabbos, they wouldn't be allowed to leave from Beis Yazek the whole day. Once they arrived there on Shabbos, they had to stay there, and they couldn't leave that courtyard. The reason why is because, as you recall from Maseches Erevin, if a person leaves his tuchum, which is normally an Isra Durabanan, one can't go beyond 2,000 almas beyond the, you know, beyond the borders of his Malkum Shvisa, where he's living, on Shabbos. So that's where the Isra Durabanan, and if a person does it bemazed, intentionally, he knows what he's doing is wrong, then once he decides to stop moving and once again comply with the halacha, or he realizes what he's done and so on and so forth, he will have to stay confined to the Dalet Amos in which he finds himself there beyond the Tchum. That's a bit mazed. If it's Bishogeg, if he didn't know what he was doing was wrong, or Baones, he was chased out from his home, whatever it is, so then you'll recall, he's allowed to move throughout the particular Rishus HaYachid in which he finds himself, so he's not confined to Dalet Amos, but he can't leave beyond the walls or the partitioned off area in which he now finds himself. So if he's in a hotel, he can go throughout the hotel, but he can't go beyond the walls of the hotel. Now, those are constraints that are put on him midurabanan. When the original durabanan was established for people who go beyond the tchum, they never considered the possibility of people leaving the tchum for the sake of doing a mitzvah. I don't know if they didn't consider it, but they didn't make separate legislation. So that would mean that the people who left for the sake of a mitzvah, like people who are edim, who are coming to testify on having seen the new moon, they would be treated the same as someone who left b'shogeg or b'onus, not willfully flouting the requirement to stay within the tchum, and therefore those people would be confined to the Rishus HaYachid in which they now find themselves, meaning in this case, Beis Yazek, which is why they'd stay in Beis Yazek the whole rest of Shabbos. But people were not keen to be trapped for the rest of Shabbos and didn't want to come necessarily, and therefore, Hiskin Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Sheyum Mahalchin Alpayim Am L'chol Ruach. Rabban Gamliel, the elder, he made a takana, a new enactment, which said that the people who came to give edus, the testimony, they were allowed to treat themselves, after having delivered their testimony, as any other Jerusalem resident, meaning they could walk throughout the city of Yerushalayim and even go beyond it 2,000 almost in all directions, like any other person who's a resident of Yerushalayim. This Rabban Gamliel is not the same Rabban Gamliel we had called Mishnayos ago, the one who told Rabbi Akiva, stop, you know, interfering with people arriving there in Lod on their way to Yavne because they won't come. That Rabban Gamliel there was after the Chorban. Remember, we talked about how it had moved already, the Sanhedrin relocated to Yavne. This is Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Rabban Gamliel the elder. This is the grandfather of that Rabban Gamliel that we usually find in the Mishnayos. And he lived in the generation before the Chorban. So he's living in Yerushalayim proper, and living, you know, whatever, around the turn of the millennium, something like that. Now, if you'll ask, why were the Edom confined to Beis Yazek? Yerushalayim is a walled city. It's all treated like Rishus HaYachid. They should be able to walk throughout Yerushalayim anyways. So the answer is that is true, except as it happens, at the time that this happened, the walls of Yerushalayim, which had been breached from earlier times by the Yavanim, had been repaired, and therefore Yerushalayim didn't have the status of Rishus HaYachid, and therefore Beis Yazek was the total Rishus HaYachid in which they found themselves. So he made a takana to make it more lenient, to allow them to treat themselves as Jerusalem residents for the rest of Shabbos, so they wouldn't be trapped, so they would not be discouraged from coming. V'lo elu bilvad, and not just these edim did Rabbi Gamliel Hazaken make things more lenient. They could walk around the rest of Shabbos without having being trapped. Ela afa chachama ba'al yaled, also a midwife who comes to help a woman give birth, who had the midwife left her tchum. Now she finds herself in someone else's house where she had to help the baby be born. Normally she'd be trapped in the house the rest of the day, but Rabbi Gamliel Hazaken said no, she can now treat herself as a resident of that new town, which or village, or wherever she is that she finds herself, and can walk 2,000 amos in all directions from there. Same goes for Vahaba Lahatzel Min HaDaleika, one who came, like the fireman, who comes to save someone else from a fire. So if he left beyond the tchum, when he finishes putting out the fire, he can walk around 2,000 amos in all directions. Umina gayas, umina nahar, umina mapolis. The same goes for other emergency services people, so to speak, who come to save fellow Jews from a gayas, that means like a marauding army, or minha nahar, from a river that's overflowed its banks, flooding everyone out. Umina mapolis, and from like a collapsed building, so they're again digging out people from the rubble. When that's finished, hare elu ka'an she'air, these emergency services people are treated like the residents of the city in which they now find themselves on Shabbos, v'yesh lem alpayim am l'chol ruach, and they are permitted to walk, like anyone else from that city, a total of 2,000 amos beyond the confines, the perimeter of the city, for the rest of that Shabbos. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Beis, Mishnah Vav 2:6, Ketzad bod kenes ha'edim, how did the Sanhedrin go about examining those witnesses who arrived to testify that they had seen the new moon on the night before? Zug Shabbat Rishon Bod Knoso Rishon, the first pair of witnesses to arrive, they're the first ones to get examined, meaning first come, first served. Umachnisen Es HaGadol Shabahen, first they would take in the more senior of the two. The idea being that they're going to, in any time they're going to interrogate witnesses, they want to make sure that they examine them independently one of the other, because the main exercise is they want to ensure that the recounting of the event in question, in this case, the seeing of the new moon, that the two accounts match one to the other. So therefore, of course, they came in the same room at the same time, or of course, they could naturally, or either intentionally or otherwise, merge their stories. So we separate them out, taking them one at a time for investigation and examination, giving kavod, proper honor, to the person who's more senior, he should go first. V'omrim lo, they say to him, emor, tell us, Ketzad Re'isa Selavana, exactly how did you see the moon? So the first question is, Lifnei Chama or La'achra Chama? Was it, I'll call it now, pointing towards the sun or away from the sun? The truth is, this and the subsequent points of the Mishnah are really easy to understand, but a little tricky to explain for me without a diagram at all. So if you want to understand really and you don't understand how it works, I'll do my very best right now, but I'm sure a simple diagram would help a lot. Here, when the sun always sets in the western sky, and everything sets in the western sky because the earth is turning in such a way that that's how it goes. Now, at the beginning of a new Jewish month, meaning when the new moon emerges, so the moon sets in the western sky a little bit after the sun sets. So it's low in the western horizon, but it will be about 10 to 20 degrees away from the sun, like to the left of the sun typically. You know, going as the sun goes down, then there's less light in the sky, and you can see this little sliver of a crescent of a new moon appearing there low on the horizon in the west. So the first question here is, that crescent new moon, which direction are the horns of the moon, I'll call it, the horns of that crescent facing? Were they pointing toward the sun or away from the sun? And as the Mishnah will say in a few moments, if the witness says that the horns of the sun were facing towards, the horns of the moon were pointing towards the setting sun, so then they've said nothing, meaning that's impossible. The scientific fact is that the moon is being lit up on half of its side, the side facing the sun. And when there's a new moon, or when what we call in English the new moon, what the Torah is going to call like the day before the new moon, the last day of the month, let's call it. So the moon is invisible, meaning that, of course, still half the moon is lit up by the sunshine, but that whole lit up side is on the other side away from what we can't see when we're in Earth, and the dark side of the moon, which is not being lit up, is what's facing us, so we see nothing. Then slowly, as the moon goes around the Earth, we get more of an angle view, and more of the lit up half of the moon becomes visible to us. So on the first day of the month, just a tiny sliver on the edge of the moon becomes visible, but it will always be that the horns of the moon, if you will, are pointing away from where the sun just set, because the sun is lighting up the half of the moon that's closest to it. So if you, in my imagination, you can imagine it's like a bow and arrow. If you imagine that the moon crescent is like the bow, so if you imagine there's an arrow shooting out of it, meaning the arrow points, of course, in the opposite direction from the horns of the bow or the horns of the crescent, that arrow will point directly to where the sun is. It could be beneath the horizon now, but where the sun is currently is exactly where you'll find if you look at the, use that line as the arrow, if you will, which is coming out from the middle of the crescent, if you will. Exactly perpendicular to the line tangent to the middle of the crescent. Okay, so So the first question is, did you see the horns pointing towards or away from the sun? And the answer always has to be the horns were away from the sun, otherwise it's just not feasible, not possible. The second question they ask them is, Litsaphona o Ladroma, did you see the moon coming down to the north or the south of where the sun had set? The sun sets in the west, but the moon can shift a little bit northward and southward. Typically, just so you should know, in the winter months, the moon kind of comes, it's shifted further north, and it comes almost like, I'll call it in the height of winter, like let's say in January 1st, whatever, it almost comes straight downwards, basically, in the latitudes where we live. And in the summer months, it comes quite obliquely. It comes from like sideways, from the far left. You know, it's much further south in the sky and moving as it comes down. Of course, it's moving towards the horizon, but it will move at an angle further north as it comes down on the western sky. So the question is, relative to where the sun was, where was the moon? Was it shifted to the north or to the south on that western horizon? And like I said before, in the winter months, it's actually shifted north of west, and in the summer months, it shifted south of west, due west. Okay, next we have a question. Kamahaya Govoa. How high was it? Meaning when you saw the moon, how elevated over the horizon was it? Ula'ayin hayanota, and exactly like how was it hanging? What was its angle? Because as I said before, in the winter months, the moon almost like kind of goes straight down so that the horns are almost pointing straight up and the imaginary arrow is pointing like straight down to the western horizon, like straight downwards. Whereas in the summer months, say in July 1st, so the horns are pointing quite sideways towards the south, and the arrow, if you will, is pointing northwards toward the western horizon. Okay, so the answer is like, how was it oriented? And after asking those various questions, and also finally, v'kamahaya rachav, just how wide was this crescent? Im amar lifnei, period, those are the set of questions they ask. Now, im amar lifnei achama, if the witnesses say that the horns of the moon were pointing away from the sun. So then lo amar klum, they've said nothing. I mean, that's just nonsense. Everything else, there could be variability, but that's just not an option. After they got the full account from the first of the two witnesses, answering all the questions we just set forth before, so then they would bring in the second guy, uvolkunoso, they would similarly test him. They'd give him the same examination. Which way was it pointing, what angle, how far north or south, how wide, how high. And im nimtzu divreim mechuvanim, if their words were aligned, meaning that they both give a very similar account of what had happened, edusim kayemas, that will be sufficient, and their testimony will be accepted, meaning the Bezin will now confirm that indeed the new moon had been sighted the night before, and they would be ready to mekadesh the new month. However, they didn't do it just yet. Instead, Ushar kol azugo sholen osam roshe dvarim. They asked a couple questions, like some main question points, to all the other pairs of witnesses. Lo shahayu tzrich lehem, not because that in truth they needed their testimony. They already established the fact based on two witnesses that already had given the testimony and had been accepted. Elek kadei shelo yetsu b'fachin nefesh. We're just concerned that these people who travel all the way to Yerushalayim to come to testimony. They show up. If we say, forget it, we don't need you, they'll leave, you know, disappointed, and then they won't come again. But Bishvil Shiu Ragil Lavo, we want them to be accustomed to come, and to come every time. And, you know, the free breakfast alone won't do it necessarily. So therefore, we make them feel important by asking some questions so they know that they don't feel it was totally useless that they came. And then after that, as we'll see in the next Mishnah, we're able to sanctify the new month. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Beis, Mishnah Zion 2:7. The Mishnah teaches how they actually make formally the new month be the new month. The Mishnah says, Rosh Beis Din Omer Mekudash. The head of the Beis Din that's doing the sanctification of the new month actually must say the word Mekudash. It is sanctified. This is learned out from the Pasuk, the requirement, because it says regarding Moshe, in this is Vayikra Perk Chav Gimel 23, Pasuk Mem Dalid, V'yadaber Moshe es Moedei Hashem. Moshe declared the Moed, the appointed times of Hashem, from which it's understood that Moshe had to actually declare it as such, Mekudash, and Moshe functioned like the head of Sanhedrin in his day, so therefore the head of the Bezin doing the sanctification must actually say Mekudash. V'chol ha'am, and everybody who's present there at the time in the Beis Din, aside from the Dayanim themselves, onan achrav, mekudash, mekudash, they respond, repeating twice, mekudash, mekudash, it is sanctified, it is sanctified. Also not from Psukim, the Pasuk says, moedei Hashem asher tikru'u osam, the appointed times of Hashem that will be declared, that they will be declared. This is Pasuk Lamed Zayin. And although it says Osam, which means them, it's written missing a vav, so it can be read as Atem. So Tikru Atem, you must declare it. And that would make it be the requirement for the people who are listening, if you will, to say Mekudash, Mekudash. And there's a requirement to say it twice because it says Mikra'e Kodesh, which is a plural, a point, holy times, plural. Therefore, there's two declarations. We're saying not the Mikra Kodesh literally means holy events, but we are from learning it to mean from the word like kore, to call it, to declare it. They have to be Mikra Kodesh, a double Kedusha declaration. And again, therefore, saying the word Mekudash based on that twice, because it's plural, Mikra Kodesh, a double declaration of Kedusha. So therefore, they say Mekudash, Mekudash. Bein Shenira Bizmano. Bein shlo nira bizmano. The requirement, says the Tanakhama, to declare the new moon as the new month as such by saying Mekudash is true whether it is decreed bizmano in its proper time. That would mean that it's on day 30. So it's the previous month was a chaser, was a short month. Or if it wasn't seen in its time, meaning it wasn't seen until the 31st day, making the previous day a male, in both cases, Mekadshino, so the Bezin's required to formally say Mekudash, and the response of Mekudash, Mekudash, both on day 30 or 31, as the case may be. Rabbi Eliezer Ber Tzadok Omer, Im lo nira bizmano, if they didn't see the new moon in its time, meaning on day 30, Ein Mekudash, Kadshin also, no need to declare it Mekudash. Shekvar Kidshu Shamayim, because already heaven, so to speak, the Bezin Shamala up in Shamayim, or nature, which took its course, and Hashem arranged it, Tupshatim. Whatever the case is, it's now been necessarily decreed to be the new month on that 31st day, because the Jewish month can only be 29 or 30 days, and therefore, for past 30 days, there's no chance for 31st day, and therefore, it's been arranged either by the Bezdin in heaven decreed it, so to speak, or since nature took its course the way Hashem arranged the world, no need further for the Bezdin down here to decree it to be Mekudash. The halacha is going to be like Rabbi Elazar Ben Yaakov, meaning that we don't have to say Mekudash on the 31st day, if you will. It simply would just automatically be, even without that declaration. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Beis, Mishnah Ches, 2:8. Demus tsuros levanos hayelo the Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel had demus means images, tsuros are shapes, levanos of the moon. He had certain like pictures of the moon in various stages. Betavla uva kosel, Beliaso, that were on like a tablet, some sort of board, and on his wall in his attic. Chebehen mara es hedyotos. He used them to show to the simple people who showed up to testify that they had seen the moon the previous night, but they weren't necessarily adept in explaining exactly its how far north or south, what the altitude was, exactly the thickness of it, and so on, how it was arranged. So he showed, and he said, Va'omer, he would just show them the picture and say, Ha'kazera Isa o kazeh? Did it look like this, or did it look like that? And that's how we would get them to give testimony. Now, that's straightforward enough. There is an important side question, which is there's an Isra Doraisa of making images of the sun, the moon, and the stars. It's based on the Pasuk in Shmos Perkhaf, Pasuk Chaf 2020, that says, Lo sa'asun iti, you will not make images of my servants that are with me, the sun, the moon, and the stars, and the constellations that serve with me, if you will. If that's the case, how did Rabban Gamliel have pictures of the moon? So there are a few different approaches to this. One approach is that the pictures were not made by him. They were made by Gentiles, and therefore there was no Isser of making such illustrations. Under normal circumstances, by that approach, it would still be Usser Midrabanan to own such pictures, lest people come to think you're using them for Avodah Zarah. But that wouldn't apply in the case of Rabban Gamliel. He was a Nasi, he had private quarters, no one was going there, he used them for the purpose he used them for, and therefore, according to that approach, it would be permissible for him to own such pictures. The second approach is that he had it sort of like a jigsaw puzzle that he would put together the pieces to construct a picture of the moon when he needed it. And then he would take the puzzle apart to sort of deconstruct the picture. So it wasn't actually a functioning image of the moon. It was like pieces that linked together. The word is chulios in the Gemara, segments that connected. So I'm using the word jigsaw puzzle, something like that. That's another approach. A third approach is that the prohibition of making such images, while certainly a din, would not be applicable if you're using images for, you know, teaching halacha or passing a din like this. It just simply wouldn't apply. Okay. At all events, the Mishnah continues almost like a new paragraph here. We have a story. Maisa, it once happened. Shabo Shnaim. Two witnesses came. Va'amru. They said, Re'inuhu Shachris b'Mizrach v'Arvis b'Marav. We saw the old moon in the morning, meaning at the time that the sun was rising in the eastern sky right before sunrise, we saw the last sliver of the old moon. And in the evening when the sun was setting, we saw right after the sun set, the first sliver of the new moon. Now, that is impossible from a scientific perspective, like a geometric perspective. Chazal of a tradition, that there's no way, there's going to be at least a 24-hour period where the moon can't be seen, at least one day every month where there's no moon to be seen, as the moon is very close, you know, angularly close to the sun. That being the case, it's impossible to see on the same day in the morning and in the evening, you know, the old moon and the new moon. And therefore, Amar Rebbe Yochanan ben Nuri, Eidei Shekerhem. They're obviously lying. These are false witnesses. Now, since the next words of the Mishnah are Kishabo Liyavne, when they arrived at Yavne, which is where the Sanhedrin was, it seems that Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri must have encountered them beforehand, heard what they were claiming to be what they had seen, and saying they're obviously not telling the truth. If that's the case, so how did that work out? So one pshat is that he was the head of the local Bezdin in the town they lived in, and they were looking to get him to send some, you know, witnesses to test that they are kosher witnesses, as we learned previously, that if the Bezdin didn't recognize you and know who you were, you had to have someone to confirm that you're a legitimate witness. Whatever the case is, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri didn't want to accept this testimony. Kishubo liYavne, but when they did arrive in Yavne, Kiblan Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel did accept their testimony, and based on their testimony that they had seen the new moon the previous night, he was Mekadesh that day as Rosh Chodesh. Now, the way the Bartanu understands this is that Rabban Gamliel did the math. He ran the numbers. He had, based on Sota Ibor, the secret of how to calculate the cycles of the moon, which is a tradition that goes all the way back, he knew that it was possible to see the moon the previous night. That was not a problem. And that being the case, he was comfortable saying they must have seen it because it was visible. As for the previous morning before that, that they claimed they saw it, okay, they're making a mistake. They must have seen a cloud or something and thought it was the moon. But he was comfortable in accepting the testimony because he knew that it was absolutely possible, based on his calculations, to see the moon on the night when they said they saw it. As for Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, so he also had the ability to make the calculations, but he calculated that it wasn't yet possible to see the moon. The reason why is because they seem to have had two different traditions, and Rabban Gamliel's tradition was that the amount of time it takes from one new moon to the next new moon, one lunation, is actually variable from month to month, whereas that wasn't the tradition of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. When we say that the cycle of the moon is 29.53 days, meaning 29 days, excuse me, yeah, meaning 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 chalakim, 793 out of 1,080 parts, 29.53 days. So that's true, but that's just the average length from one new moon to the next new moon. But since the Earth's orbit is elliptical, it doesn't always work out exactly that. The moon, the month, the synodic month, as it appears, could be as short as 29.18 and as long as 29.93 days. So it's the variability. And therefore, it seems that Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri didn't have that tradition. He thought they're always the same at 29.53, whereas Rabban Gamliel understood there's a variation possible, and according to his calculations, it could be seen. Therefore, he accepted them as acceptable witnesses and was Mekadesh the Chodesh based on that testimony. Now, va'od, a new story, like a new paragraph, another story, but a different story. Boshnaim, two witnesses came, va'amru, and they said, re'inuhu bizmano, we saw the new moon in its proper time, meaning on the 30th day of the month. This actually was the month of Elul. So it was on the 30th day of the month of Elul, we saw, well, it would have been the 30th day of the month, we saw the new moon, and therefore this morning can be declared the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Uvaleil iburo lo nira. However, that night, the night after the first day of Rosh Hashanah that was decreed as Rosh Hashanah, lo nira, it couldn't be seen. There was no moon to be seen. Now, the moon never moves in retrograde motion. If it's true that there's one or two nights, every month where you cannot see a moon. But if you could see the moon yesterday, so then for sure you should be able to see it today. The moon moves across the sky further and further from the sun at a rate of about 13 degrees a night. You can get the number pretty easily yourself, because if you figure that the average month is 30 days, to use a round number, and there's 360 degrees in the full circle of the sky, so that means 30 goes into 360 12 times. So that means you'd have 12 degrees times 30 days, give you 360 degrees, or a full circle. So about 12 degrees. The truth is it's actually 13 degrees because 29 and a half, etc. But the point is, every day it moves a little further up, meaning, just to speak that out, the time that you see the new moon, the first time it'll be the sun setting in the western sky, and then, 12 degrees above that, if you will, there, plus minus, depends, of course, from month to month, but you'll be able to see the new moon, okay? The next day when you come, it should be 24 degrees above the horizon at sunset. So it gets higher up and more prominent and actually also bigger as the days go on. So it doesn't make sense that you could see the moon yesterday if you can't see it today. And that being the case, it's a little fishy. Nevertheless, Vikiblan Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel accept their testimony. He made that morning Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Tishrei, even though that night, what was like, I'll call it the night of the second day of Tishrei, there was no moon to be seen. Amar Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus objected. He said, something has obviously gone wrong here. Eidei Shekerhen. They must not be telling the truth. They couldn't have seen the moon yesterday if we can't see it today. Heich me'idin al ha'isha she'yalada ulamachar kresa bein shinela. That's impossible. I'll translate it idiomatically. It's impossible that we could see the moon yesterday, but you can't see it today. There's no such thing. The literal translation of what he says is, how could they testify that a woman gave birth, remember the word like molad, it's like a new rebirth of the moon each cycle. That's the metaphor here. So how could you say that a woman gave birth today, ulamachar, but then tomorrow we see her and her kreisa ben shineha, her like belly is still between her teeth, meaning she's like, you know, bursting as an obviously overly pregnant woman. That's obviously impossible. She couldn't give birth yesterday and be pregnant today. Amar lo Rabbi Yehoshua, Rova ani estevarecha. Rabbi Yehoshua said, I am with you, Rabbi Dosa ben Hurknus. This simply doesn't make sense, and therefore we should not accept their testimony. We should overturn their testimony, as most Rishonim learn, and not have yesterday, have this morning, in other words, have been the first of Tishrei. Now, the next mission will continue on exactly where this left off, so I'll pick up over there, but just understand that the Rabbi Yehoshua is a very important person. Rabbi Yehoshua is the Av Bezin. He's the head of Sanhedrin. He's the Gadol Hador. So he is taking sides against Rabbi Gamliel. More in the next Mishnah about this story. Rosh Hashanah Perek Beis Mishnah Test 2-9, the last of the Perek. And really, we were picking up where we left off in the previous Mishnah, which was in a very tense moment, where Rabbi Yehoshua, the Gadol Hador, and the Av Bezin of Sanhedrin had said that it was impossible that yesterday should have been Rosh Chodesh, if tonight we still can't see the new moon, and therefore Rabbi Gamliel should overturn things and make today be Rosh Chodesh, meaning Rosh Hashanah, and not yesterday. Rabbi Gamliel, being the Nasi, for his part, wasn't backing down, and he insisted that yesterday was Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh, and today is already the second day of the new year. Now, that would lead potentially to a very big schism in Klal Yisrael, because you have a split between the Nasi and the Av Bezdin, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua, and the consequences are that in 8 or 9 days from now, we're going to have Yom Kippur. Is it 8 or 9 days? And obviously the stakes are high. People take Yom Kippur very seriously. When are they going to fast? 1 day, the second day, both days. And if you have a split in Klal Yisrael like that, two different Yom Kippurs, it's like there's going to be two different sects, two different, there's an issue of losses go to do. You can't do that. You can't have different factions doing different things in Klal Yisrael. Everyone's going to have uniformity. Now, in the time of the Second Temple, there did become two major groups, the legitimate groups, the schools of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, aside from all sorts of illegitimate groups, like the Stukim and the Baisusim and the Essenes, but there were such a thing. There was such a thing as, you know, when Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai disagree on something as Tahor or Tameh or Mutter or Asar, there was almost like, the Gemara says it, it's almost as if there were two different Torahs in Klal Yisrael, which of course is a very precarious situation. Rabbi Gamliel took the position that after the Chorban, the Jews no longer had the luxury of allowing for Kishtei Toros, if there were two Toros in Klal Yisrael. We already were, had been decimated by the Romans. Times were very difficult. They were already working out of Yavne instead of Yerushalayim. And Klal Yisrael was really downtrodden and depressed. And he didn't see it as a viable option to, in that state of Gullus, to have like Klal Yisrael going their separate ways into different schisms. So that was a recipe for social disaster. And therefore, he was insistent. And this is not going to be the only time we see in the Gemara that he was insistent that it has to be his way and there could be no toleration of variance. Not because he was, doing it for his own interests, but because we felt just absolutely, it was essential for Klal Yisrael to have a uniform halachic approach and uniform practice. And therefore, he put his foot down and said, nothing doing Rabbi Yehoshua, we're not allowing Rabbi Yehoshua to disagree with me publicly regarding when Yom Kippur falls out, lest we have this schism in Klal Yisrael. And therefore, the Mishnah says, Shalach lo Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel sent a message to Rabbi Yehoshua. Gozerani alecha shetavo etzli b'maklecha uvmosecha b'yom ha-kippurim shechal lios b'cheshbonach. I decree upon you formally that you must arrive in my court before me with your stick in hand and your money belt around your waist, on the Yom Kippur that according to your cheshbon, meaning what I call the 11th of Tishrei. So if Rabbi Yehoshua would show up with a walking stick, which you can't carry with through the Shusharabim on Yom Kippur, it's like Shabbos, and money in hand, whatever it is, of course, that would indicate to everybody that he had backed down and was agreeing that Yom Kippur wasn't today, it was the previous day, like Rabbi Gamliel said, and that would ensure uniformity amongst Klal Yisrael. Now, this, of course, was very distressing to Rabbi Yehoshua, who held that that would be Yom Kippur, and he would be doing Nisr Doraisa of Chil Yom Kippur. So, Halach Umatzo Rabbi Akiva Meitzer. Rabbi Akiva went to visit him, attempting to, he wanted to assuage his pain, and Rabbi Akiva found that Meitzer, really, he was suffering terribly, in this internal conflict of what do I do? Do I do what Rabbi Gamliel said, and I understand why he's saying that, in terms of what's good for the uniformity and, you know, larger well-being of the community, but it's terrible for me because I hold it's Yom Kippur and I can't do that on Yom Kippur. So he's really suffering. He wished he would have done anything, literally, as the Gemara says, he would have endured, you know, tremendous suffering elsewhere rather than have to endure this terrible predicament that he found himself in. Amar lo, and Rabbi Akiva said to him, Yeshli lilmot shakol masha asa Rabbi Gamliel asui. Rabbi Akiva, who was the Talmud of Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Akiva had two main Rebbes, Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer. This is Rabbi Yehoshua's Rebbe. So Rabbi Akiva said, I have a limud from the Pasuk that I can learn out that shows that what Rabbi Gamliel did is legitimate, it's binding, and you have no reason to fear. You should observe that as Yom Kippur, and that's fine. You have no reason to not be comfortable. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Ela Moadei Hashem Mikra'e Kodesh Asher Tikru Osam. Now, it actually says it three times. It says Tikru Osam, and in those psukim, and Rabbi Akiva understood that the repeated superfluous phrase there says that you get to declare it, and it doesn't matter three times whether you did it. The halacha is, as the Mishnah says, Bein Bizmanan, Bein Shlo Bizmanan, Ein Li Moadot Ela Elu. Rabbi Akiva says that Hashem understands, says that whether you decree it in its, what let's call it as scientific reality when the new moon was visible or not, it doesn't matter. The only Rosh Chodesh that I recognize as Hashem is the Rosh Chodesh that the Bezin Shalmata decrees. That's all that matters. That's what's Koveya, that's what determines it. And Rabbi Akiva says the drush is the Osam tell you Atem three times, whether your mistake was a shogeg, it was an accident, or whether your mistake was amazing, it was intentional, you actually purposefully declared the wrong day Rosh Chodesh for whatever reasons you did, or whether you've been misled by Adam. In all those cases, it doesn't matter. If the Bezin declares that Rosh Chodesh, it's Rosh Chodesh, and that's how Rosh Chodesh works. It's a halachic reality, not an astronomical reality. Bolo Eitzel Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus. Now, the proper pronouns here to understand are Rabbi Yehoshua. Now went to visit Rabbi Dos ben Hyrcanus. Now Rabbi Dos had started this, if you recall from the previous Mishnah, but it seems from not here in the Mishnah that Rabbi Dos had sort of backed down and sort of, let's call it now, he'd aligned himself with Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Gamliel, that we were going to go with Rabbi Gamliel, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and not the Rabbi Yehoshua one. So he backed down from his position. Now, therefore, Rabbi Dosa also tells Rabbi Yehoshua that he should back down. Amar lo, Rabbi Dosa said to Rabbi Yehoshua, Imbon anu ladun achar beis dino shel Rabbi Gamliel. If we would now come to query the legitimacy of Rabbi Gamliel's bezdin, declaring yesterday as whatever day it was earlier in the week, that first day as Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Chodesh, tzrichen anu ladun achar kol bezdinu bezdin she'amad miyimos Moshe varachshav. We would need to query every ruling of every Bezdin that ever happened. If the Bezdin stuff isn't binding, then maybe the calendar's all wrong and maybe who knows what. We have to queer everybody. But we don't do that. Why? Shneamar, the Pasuk says, V'yal Moshe v'Aaron Nadav v'Aviyu. Moshe and Aaron and Nadav and Aviyu, his sons, all went up. And v'shivim mizikne Yisrael. And also 70 more elders. And now Rabbi Dosa gives his drasha. V'lamano nisparshu shmosen shel zakenim. Why did the Torah not say who these 70 were? That is nameless elders. El lamed. It's because it's coming to teach you. Shekol shlosha shlosha sh'amdu bezdin al Yisrael. Whenever you have a legitimate bezdin, harehu kaveis dino shel Moshe. They're legitimate. The Torah has confirmed authority upon them, and that's binding. And they're just what they say is just as binding as a bezdin with Moshe Rabbeinu himself. So, that being the case, Rabbi Gamliel, which is legitimate Bezdin, of course, declaring that, I'll call it 30th day to be Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, that's binding. That's it. There's no going down. And now Rabbi Yeshua has these two points. Rabbi Dosa back down, explaining that every bezin is legitimate. If they're legitimate bezin, their decrees are legitimate. And Rabbi Kiva's drasha, which says that when the bezin declares Rosh Chodesh is Rosh Chodesh, regardless if there's some astronomical mistake. And therefore, Natal Maklo Ma'osa Biado, Rabbi Yeshua took his walking stick and his money in his hand. V'halach liyavne, he went to Yavne, Eitzel Rabban Gamliel, to see Rabban Gamliel, B'yom Shechal Yom HaKippurim Liyos B'cheshbono, on the day that Yom Kippur fell out according to his calculations, meaning what we'll call the 11th of Tishrei according to Rabban Gamliel. When he showed up, Amad Rabban Gamliel stood up for him, certainly a sign of deference. V'nashko al rosho, and he kissed him on his head, which is maybe not a sign of deference, but a sign of showing, you know, he's like a father figure to him, if you will. And Amar lo, and Rabban Gamliel said to Rabbi Yeshua, Bo b'shalom Rebbe v'talmidi, come in peace, my master and my student. Master Rebbe b'chochma, in terms of wisdom, because of course Rabbi Yeshua was the Gadol Hador, and Rabban Gamliel was not disputing that. Rabban Gamliel said, you are absolutely the greater Talmud Chacham, and I defer to you. V'talmidi, but you've taken the position of being my subordinate, like my student, shekibalta es devarai, that you accepted my words, meaning you accepted my psak, that we are doing what we're doing, calling that day Rosh Hashanah and not backing down. And Rabbi Yeshua here, you know, stands for he did the right thing, and, you know, I'll call it happily ever after. However, if you learn the Gemara in Brachas, Daf Chavches, you will see not happily ever after. It seems that the students present, although this story is over. But they saw this episode as a terrible affront to the coveted Rabbi Yeshua, and that Rabbi Gamliel really was overstepping his bounds and out of line, although he had the authority to do what he did, and they ended up, you know, following this method. They certainly I'll call it held it against him as something that was an inappropriate way to give proper kavod to Rabbi Yeshua, the Gadol Hador. And later on, as clear in Gemara Brachos, they took umbrage and later on actually took action when it happened yet again, really for the third time. And with that, we finished the second parak, and we have one more mishnah to go in the next parak about Kiddush HaChodesh before we move on to the Lachos of Shofar.